This reading from the second book written by Luke the Evangelist following the Gospel of Luke, the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 18. Now a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was an eloquent man, well-versed in the scriptures. He'd been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, though he knew only of the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him and expounded to him the way of God more accurately. This story is not often read at ordinations, but I think it should. Here we've got a young, energetic preacher in training, as it were, named Apollos, who's charismatic and gifted. He just doesn't know the whole story. He's kind of a work in progress. And Paul, apparently, sends two of his leading partners, teachers, Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla getting top billing, interestingly enough. And they go and they sort of school him up. They teach him the rest of the story, and he spends the rest of his life as a powerful and charismatic preacher. Apollos is a work in progress, and Priscilla and Aquila teach him new things. We were home last Thursday evening watching the progression of 4th of July celebrations. It's kind of like New Year's, you know, the ball drops in Australia and then New York and across the country. Well, we were watching the celebrations of people gathering in large open spaces in New York and Boston and Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Los Angeles and so on. And I was thinking if there was a Martian chronicler of life on Earth who didn't really know all the details but just could see, you know, the news feeds of what was going on July the 4th, 2013, that creature would notice that people are gathering in public spaces and they're celebrating and they're shooting off fireworks in Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Los Angeles and Cairo. Apparently they celebrate the 4th of July in Cairo. Well, maybe not. But they're certainly celebrating, freedom. And in the United States, our celebration of freedom has been pretty much consistent in its character, celebrating those who have fought for our way of life and who continue to do so. In Egypt, kind of a work in progress, sort of a scary one. Not quite sure what's going to happen next. But we all kind of want the same things, and we all celebrate when we think we're closer to what we believe we need. Egypt is a work in progress on the freedom front. And then I started thinking. Freedom in the United States continues to be something of a work in progress. Who will be free and how? And how much? It's an interesting question. 2013 is the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, where we fought to adjudicate that question at the cost ultimately of 800,000 American lives. Who will be free and how much? Not categorically different, though certainly in consequence, different from decisions that were handed down this last week or two by the Supreme Court. Decisions that are pending in the State House of Texas. Who will be free and how much and under what circumstances? Freedom in the U.S. continues to be a work in progress. Essentially, it's a negotiation, as are all laws. There's a development of statutes that are implemented, negotiated, sometimes renegotiated, and adjudicated, and so on. And as of late, the freedom question involves tension between liberty and security. And the latest focal person on whom that debate rests is the guy who's seeking asylum somewhere because he can't come home because he sent forth information that belonged in the secret files. The tension between liberty and security. A work in progress. God isn't finished with us yet, kind of like Apollos, as we seek to continue to grow in our freedom and in our faith and in our leadership. It's true not only for the country as a whole. It's true, I think, for the relationship between church and state, metaphorically, faith and science. That's been a work in progress for some time. I think of Galileo and Pope Paul V, and then Pope Gregory, and then Pope Urban, all of whom took Galileo to task for challenging scientifically what we believed by faith, that the earth was the center of the cosmos and that the sun revolved around it and that it was flat and God made it that way, and that was the end of the story, until Galileo ran a few numbers, looked through a better telescope, measured the movements of this and that, and applied the principles of geometry and said, wait a minute, I don't think it works that way. He spent the end of his life in exile, and yet science progresses, and we have learned more about the relationship between and perhaps the tension between faith and science. It's really the same debate. Galileo and Paul V, they're having the same conversation that small-town school boards are having with biology textbook writers today. Tension between faith and science. My own thinking has progressed on this, I think, to a point where, at the moment, I can at least say the tension between faith and science is tense because one is applying to the other the questions the other should be answering. Science answers the question, what was the process? Now, clearly, we don't know everything scientifically that we will know, but we've got a fairly good idea that 5 billion or so years ago, a process started. What basis it started? Well, we don't really know. That then asks the theologians for insight. The theologian says, well, we believe that a divine being put this in motion, and the how is less important than the why, you see. The scientist answers the question, what was the process? The theologians and those people of faith answer the question, what's the purpose? What is the purpose? And at that point, if you focus on what's the point and the purpose of our life together as people of God, well, if you believe God was in charge of it, who cares how long it took? My own thinking has evolved to that point, that if we can separate the process and purpose question, faith and science can get along just fine. I will tell you that in my life, one of the most ardently faithful people I ever met was a geology professor who, to the extent that we can know anything scientifically, knew the geologic record and understood the evolutionary process, which actually, in his view, bolstered his faith because it helped him, the process question helped him understand the purpose question. And yet, we're still a work in progress. We're a work in progress as we seek to answer the question, who will be how free and under what circumstances? And what is the relationship between our faith life and our civic life? And it all comes down at the end, I think, thirdly, to the work in progress that we all are in forming our worldview, shaping our values, and watching that process evolve. I try to teach my hordes of freshmen one thing, and that is that there are at least two, and probably more, but two relatively easy to conceptualize large perspectives on our life together, our culture as we interact. To put it simplistically, on one hand, you have a kind of populist, conservative, to really oversimplify it, red state kind of worldview. On the other hand, some would call progressive, some would call liberal, sort of blue state kind of worldview. They both begin with very different sets of assumptions. They have very different ways of imagining how those assumptions would play out in policy. And yet, and this is the most important thing I try to teach freshman sociology students, you can take a blue state perspective and argue both sides of pretty much any issue. And you can take a red state perspective and argue pretty much both sides of any issue. Watch this. Let's take a blue state point of view, whatever it is that means to you. The perspectives associated with political liberals, for example. And let's imagine the question of nationalizing health care. Fairly easy to argue in favor of it from that point of view. But you can also argue against it from the perspective of the distribution of power, which is what blue state politics tends to focus on. You can argue against nationalizing health care because, in a sense, it takes one unjust social institution, the business world and the economy, that oppresses those who are without health care, and replaces it with another potentially unjust and oppressive social institution, that of government. So it doesn't help. That's not generally how blue state folks argue it, but you can, and that's the point. Take a red state mentality, a red state perspective, a red state set of assumptions. Pretty easy to argue against same-sex marriage. On the other hand, if you believe at least part of what the biologists tell us, that human beings are not particularly monogamous. That's why, as a species, we have had to invent the concept of marriage to strengthen monogamy and strengthen families. You could take the logic of that argument and say, why should we not, and why are we not better off if we apply the logic of that to two men and two women who want to get married? We preserve and protect monogamy. We allow the adoption of children. It makes sense that we should use the logic that gives us monogamy as a good thing to everybody. Now, not everybody can do that. Not everybody can argue polarizing opinions from both perspectives. But if we are going to move our thinking forward, I think we have to learn to do that. I think, I'm just guessing, that almost nobody in here would say that their particular point of view on issues related to race relations or gender equality is the same as it was when we were teenagers. You know, we've rethought a great deal of things, for better or worse. So we're all a work in progress on most issues of values, even, and ethics and politics. So our country, freedom is a work in progress. Our church and our country, a work in progress on matters of faith and science. And our own thinking evolves over time. Is there any connecting thread or principle or image that we can take with us that's a sort of touchstone for all of this? I think I go back to the text of Apollos and Priscilla and Aquila. Luke the evangelist goes into great detail on this story about a relatively obscure character in the New Testament, I think to make a point. Here we have an energetic young preacher that will do a great deal of good for the Christian movement. He's a work in progress. He needs more schooling. Who goes and teaches him? Let me suggest to you, if you can remember one thing from the work in progress discussion this morning, remember this and apply the logic of it to your own thinking about other things. The co-founder of the first theological seminary, and arguably the senior faculty member, was a woman. Amen.